So today we're going to talk about two very different topics, but both within the topic of religion. One is some of the most sublime philosophy of the soul that came from Rupa Goswami, we talked about that yesterday, and actually other thinkers as well. And then we're going to talk about how the Europeans arrived in India, and they did not put their best foot forward. They put their, in one sense, their worst foot forward. And we'll see how that happened, how the Europeans came to India. Anyway, speaking about Rupa, there is a, well, since this is a religious studies class, we can use big words. There's a branch of philosophy or theology called eschatology, which means the account that a particular person or group gives as to what happens at the end. Now, this could be the end of an individual life, like what happens when you die, where do you go, according to your religion. Or it can also be what happens to the world, like is there an end time for the world? And of course, one of the most famous doctrines is apocalyptic, yeah. And the word Sanskrit, well, no, this is Greek, but it's related to Sanskrit. Anyway, this word literally means to discover. To discover, the idea being at the end of time, the judge will come, and the Son of Man, and, you know, all hell breaks loose, and heaven also breaks loose. And so that's eschatology. Like what you think happens at the end, either at the end of your life or at the end of a particular period of the earth, what happens at the end. So we're going to talk about the concept of what happens when you die, according to the Vaishnava tradition, which is, in a sense, among many traditions in India, is perhaps the single most influential one. As I've said before, the two great historical epics of India, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, are basically Vaishnava texts. The first great temples were Vaishnava temples. The Brahminical community were supposed to be in goodness, in the quality of goodness, although they worshipped many different deities, had a special relationship with Vishnu, who is the god of goodness, preserver of the world, and so on. And the single most important text, I think everyone admits, in Hinduism is the Bhagavad Gita, in which the speaker is Krishna, or Vishnu. And so, according to the Bhagavad Gita, and then we'll get into Rupa, according to the Bhagavad Gita, basically, you know, as you reap, so you shall sow. At the time of death, your consciousness, well, you must have read about these near-death experiences, where people report that their whole life sort of flashed before them. They saw their whole life. And so it's something like that. But at the time of death, the sum total of your decisions, the exercise of your free will, what you chose to say, to do, what your thoughts were, just the, you know, how you lived your life, that all gets totaled up. And that consciousness, that state of consciousness, which you've been cultivating throughout your life, and carries you to another body. And there's one statement in the Gita where Krishna says, "Vidvanga janti sattvasta." Those who live in goodness go up, and those who live in passion stay more or less where they are, and those who live in ignorance go down. It's not an eternal hell, despite a misinterpretation, sort of a gross misinterpretation of one verse in the Gita, where Krishna says that those who do bad things perpetually will have to go down. It's not at all a description of eternal hell, which was the sublime contribution of early Christianity. But it's the idea that that as long as one behaves inappropriately, there will always be reactions. And this will go on perpetually. So you can't win a war of attrition, so to speak, with the universe. Like sometimes your parents, you just keep asking for something so many times they finally can't stand it anymore, like give you the keys to the car or something. But that doesn't happen. And then Krishna says the laws of nature always act. So, now, Ultimately, Krishna talks about what he calls, well, in Sanskrit, he calls it Madhama. Mad means my, and Dhamma means abode. Krishna says that there is an eternal eternal abode, or you'd say kingdom of God, although they don't really use the word kingdom. It's the idea being that if you live in a place where all souls are pure, you don't really need like formal government and laws and police and soldiers and things like that. So it's not really described as a kingdom of God, just as a very sublime place. And it's eternal, it's self-luminous, according to the Bhagavad Gita, and so on, and everything there is conscious. So, within the Vaishnava tradition, they presented the understanding, and this is not only Rupa, it's also going back even many centuries before Rupa, one of the greatest of all Vaishnava theologians, Ramanuja, the Vedantist, who responded to Shankara. The idea that there is a spiritual body. And this is not only found in the Vaishnava tradition, it's found in other traditions in India, and it's found in certain mystic traditions of Christianity and Judaism as well, and even Islam. The idea being that rather than this material body being resurrected, so as the old gospel song goes, them bones will rise again, rather than the material body being resurrected, the idea here is that we are purely spiritual beings. And I think the people on this side would argue that trying to resurrect the material body is sort of a sign of attachment. They would say that we tend to identify with the material body rather than the eternal soul. And because of this attachment, we seek an eschatology. We seek a liberation or salvation in which we get to keep our material body. Whereas the many world religion traditions, including this one, there's the idea that there is a spiritual body, a pure spiritual body. And so what kind of spiritual body do you get? Like, is there a catalog? Can you, test drive different spiritual bodies? The idea given by Ramanuja is that every one of us has an eternal spiritual identity, which at the present time is concealed from us, or we just don't understand it. But it's really there. I mean, you could give, I suppose, a crude argument that at the time of your birth, even as a newly born infant, you actually have a genetic code which will determine that you will, let's say, grow to be so high and look a certain way and have perhaps a certain, intelligence level, whatever. And a lot of this is genetically programmed at the time of birth, but it unfolds, it manifests over time. And so the idea here is that we actually, as Ramanuja puts it in his Vedanta commentary, we actually have an eternal spiritual form, which already exists. And this same doctrine is found in a book, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Anyway, I keep me out of trouble, I think it's on the board. This is the term that's found in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nitya Siddha, eternally established or eternally perfected. The idea being that we have an eternal spiritual form that we've forgotten. And you find this in Plato also, the idea that ultimate enlightenment is a question of remembering, that we have to remember who we really are. It's something, the example is always given of a dream, where at the time of dreaming we forget our real identity. When we wake up, we remember. And so the idea is that enlightenment is to wake up, to remember who we really are eternally. And who we really are is that we are all eternal spiritual persons, pure, pure consciousness, free of lust, greed, envy, and so on and so forth, all those nasty things. So, now as far as the spiritual body, what Rupa explains specifically is that there are five primary relationships you can have with God. In any case, it's a relationship of love, but there are different ways that you can love someone. And Rupa teaches, in fact, the tradition teaches, even long before Rupa, that you choose, according to your own nature, according to your own spiritual desires, you choose to love God in a particular way. In this case, of course, God is Krishna. And so the idea is that you can love God as your supreme Lord. Bless you. In other words, where you feel that you are a servant of God, that God is great, I mean infinitely great, and your nature is to render service to that great person. And then another relationship is friendship. That some souls may find that the relationship of servant and master, or Lord and, I guess, subservient, is not, somehow it lacks intimacy. That if you are in awe of someone, if you see someone as your master, there's some separation, there's some reserve. Whereas with an intimate friend, there's very little reserve. It's just you're completely intimate with your best friend. And so the idea here is that, now actually, I left one out at the beginning. I'll give the Sanskrit terms for this. Not that anyone's going to memorize them, but it'll give me something to do. So, there's Shanta Rasa. Remember I told you that Rasa means flavor, and Shanta means her peaceful. So there's a type of love of God where one simply appreciates and admires God. There are some people that we will never meet in our lives, but we admire them. We may read about them or hear about them or see them in movies. We don't really do anything for them. We don't really render some personal service to them. We're not friends with them. But there is a type of relationship in the sense that we admire them. We appreciate them. So that's considered to be, in a sense, the least intimate form of love. And then the one I just mentioned, which is called Dasya Rasa, servitude, where you love God as your eternal Lord. And that inspires you. And then, becoming more intimate, there's a relationship. See how we're going up? Did you notice that? I planned ahead. Anyway. So there's a relationship called friendship. Friendship, from the Sanskrit word sakha, friend, where you become an intimate friend of Krishna. And when Krishna actually came to this world, all these different relationships were visible. There were people that didn't really know Krishna or didn't really interact with him that intimately, but simply appreciated him, admired him, even loved him from afar, you could say. There were people who were directly serving Krishna, especially when he went from Vrindavan to Mathura and then Dwarka. And there were people who were intimate friends of Krishna. For example, Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita was a famous friend of Krishna. In fact, they were real buddies. They were super tight. And there's a beautiful description, say, in the Mahabharata, where Arjuna went to visit Krishna in Dwarka in West India, and on the island where Krishna lived. And apparently there was a resort area near that island on the mainland, the beautiful mountain that you can still visit today, actually, called Rivataka. And it was kind of the resort area for the Yadu dynasty, which Krishna was the leader of. And the description is how they would go there in the evening under the stars. There would be entertainment. This is thousands of years ago, but some things don't change. There were dancers, singers, you know, kind of like the old Ed Sullivan show. Anyway, so there would be entertainment on a stage, and then at night, Krishna and Arjuna would sort of lie under the stars, you know, in these cots because the weather was warm, and just talk. And you know, they were intimate friends. They were very close, intimate friends. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna reveals to Arjuna that Krishna is the source of the universe, Arjuna is sort of bewildered and says, "Please forgive me because sometimes I made fun of you, or sometimes I didn't take you that seriously, because I just loved you as my friend, and I didn't realize who you were." And of course, there was no harm, no offense there, because the idea being that that God actually is more pleased by a soul that loves God intimately without all this reserve and veneration, if the love is pure. It can't be sort of an artificial, like taking someone. It's like if someone comes up to you that doesn't really care about you and doesn't really know you, kind of puts their arm around you and says, "Hey, how you doing, buddy?" It's not so pleasing. But if it's someone you ask that you love and that loves you, then of course the intimacy is very pleasing. So beyond Sakya, There is another relationship called Vatsalya. Actually, from the word Vatsa, which means a calf. And in Sanskrit, ancient Sanskrit, one very common term of endearment is Vatsa, to call someone a calf. Like parents call children because, anyway, the calf, because the way the cow loves the calf and so on. And we call people honey and stuff like that, and that's just a, it's a food that comes from bees. So, Vatsalya is where the soul actually loves Krishna as if the soul were Krishna's parent. And famously, when Krishna lived in Vrindavan, where he played as a child, his foster parents, Nanda and Yashoda, his father Nanda, his mother Yashoda, they were so attached to Krishna that they really could think of nothing else but Krishna. And if you think of loving parents, if you're fortunate enough to have very good loving parents, it's really a kind of selfless love. They really will do anything for their children. And so it's said that, now, no one is really the parent of God. This is what the Vaishnava theologians would say. No one is really the parent of God. However, there is a power called Yoga Maya. You may remember the term Maya, which means illusion. But in the Vaishnava theology, there are two kinds of Maya. One is called, Mahamaya, like just the normal illusion, like we're in this world. We think it's permanent, but it's really temporary. We think we are the body, but we're really not. We're really the soul. We think we can be happy by exploiting the material world. We really can't. We really can only be happy by loving God and other souls. And so, Maya, in one sense, it's a very common word. It's like in the whole Vedanta tradition, it's just one of the key terms in all of this Indian philosophy, actually, including Buddhism. And so, Maya means just the generic illusion of the world, just being clueless about who you really are and what you're really doing down here and what the world really is. But there's another kind of Maya talked about, which is Yoga Maya. And Yoga Maya is an illusion that actually increases your purity and your love and ultimately your understanding. It's an illusion which brings you to a higher spiritual level rather than keeping you at a lower spiritual level. And so to give one simple example, which I may have given before, there's a famous story in the life of Krishna when he was just a very young child, where he was playing with his friends, and then his brother, who was almost the same age, Balaram, came and complained to their mother, Yashoda, that Krishna was eating dirt. I mean, he's a little, real little boy. And so, his mother called Krishna and demanded to know, you've been eating dirt. And he said, no, they were lying. He said, you can look at my mouth if you don't believe me. So he opened his mouth. His mother looked in, and suddenly she saw the entire universe within his mouth. And that was surprising. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is surprising to see the universe in your little child's mouth. So she was so startled by this. She was so startled by this that she began to feel that it's just an illusion to think that I'm Krishna's mother. How can anyone be Krishna's mother if the whole universe is within him? And so after a moment, Krishna closed his mouth and withdrew that vision because, it said, he did not want to lose the love that Yashoda felt for him as his mother. That because she believed she was Krishna's mother, she loved him with extraordinary intensity, and Krishna preferred that love. That love he felt was more pleasing, more intense, more pure than if she simply kind of fell into rank as one of the innumerable reverential worshippers of God. Because being reverentially worshipped, it can get very old if you're the one being worshipped. And that, you know, having a bunch of people like bowing down and being very reverential, it's nice, but it's like, could I talk to someone out there? Because everyone is sort of too reverential to talk to you. So it may seem nice to have everyone sort of bowing, scraping, worshiping you, but it gets very old. So Krishna actually preferred this, showed his love, motherly love, And so Yogamaya, this is a key concept actually in Vaishnavism. Yogamaya refers to that spiritual illusion which makes souls forget Krishna's position as God, so that every soul will just freely love Krishna according to their own heart. The idea being that it's like if you have a lot of money, if you're like really rich, you will attract a lot of parasites. People who are very rich or very powerful are magnets for parasites. And actually, I mean, if you study these things, you'll find that it's really like this. People who are very rich or very famous or very powerful have a really hard time figuring out who their real friends are. Because when you have all this stuff, like people want to hang out with a famous person or rich person or powerful person, and so it's really hard to make true friends. Because everybody wants something. Everybody wants to bask in the glow of your notoriety, your celebrity. And it can be a very lonely situation, which accounts for some of the erratic, eccentric behavior of celebrities, perhaps. So it actually can become a very lonely life. A very lonely life because, I mean, few people are so pure at heart that even though you're incredibly rich and famous and powerful, that means nothing to me. I mean, who can say, like, that means nothing to me? It actually does mean something to most people. You know, they get kind of a little thrill out of it, like, oh my God, I'm friends with this really famous person. Or this person is so wealthy, I wonder if they'll think of me now and then. So anyway, people who have, all that material stuff going for them can often be kind of lonely. And so Krishna, as the Vaishnava theology goes, has... I mean, imagine if you're God, right, to figure out who your real friends are. You know, imagine if you're actually Bruce Almighty. So if you're actually God, then the problem is that everybody wants something. I mean, think of your sort of average prayer. Everybody wants something. And so how do you ever have real friends? Of course, if we think of God as someone who is like somehow inconceivably godly and holy and therefore does not deign to even think about things like friendship and love and all that, it just, you know, he's too busy just being majestic. But the Vaishnav conception is that God is a real person. He's the supreme person, but he's actually a person. And that's why we are persons. And so this Yogamaya, Krishna, according, again, to this Vaishnava theology, Krishna chooses to live in the spiritual world. There are different neighborhoods, you know. And when you get there, you'll get a map and a little navigation system. But the idea is that of all the various spiritual worlds, there are many spiritual worlds. There's an infinite spiritual world in which there are many different places that souls can go according to their own desires. But that Krishna chooses to live forever in a place where no one is worshiping him as God. And everyone who is there because they love Krishna, period. And so, let's say you meet someone, and you don't know that person's a billionaire, or very famous. I'll give you a practical example, actually. I'm from Southern California, as you can tell from my tan, I suppose. But anyway, my sister-in-law, my brother's sister, was good friends with a lady, I can't remember her name, but she was the wife of a famous director. And so, anyway, they would, you know, go hang out at the studios and everything. And so one day she was talking to some guy, and my brother's sister is, my brother's wife. Go get you the kinship tree. Okay, my brother's wife is from Brazil. And you know, at that point, it's kind of learning about America. Anyway, so there was some guy hanging, she said, oh, I think I know you. And he said, really? He said, yeah. Do you work at the Whole Foods over in Beverly Hills? And he said, no, I don't work there. And she said, yeah, I'm sure you work at the Whole Foods there. And so he kept trying to convince her, no, I don't, I really don't work at Whole Foods. So she said, well, what do you do? Then he said, well, I'm an actor. Anyway, make a long story short, it was Tom Cruise. So... But he was so delighted that she was just like totally not into, you know, him as a cruise missile. So he was so delighted by that that he took her out to lunch. Because it was like, this is so refreshing. Actually, anyway, I'm full of stories from Southern California. There's a park where I live, and one time there's all these paparazzi because Tom Cruise's former wife was at the soccer game with their kid. But one time in my backyard, there were actually paparazzi, like climbing on the fence in my backyard. And I said, excuse me, but I said, do you mind? Anyway, because there was some famous singer in the medical center behind the house. So it's crazy out there. So anyway, no more anecdotes for now about Southern California. But the idea is that if you are actually in a big position, it can be very refreshing to find someone that really loves you. And so according to the Vaishnava theology, the Krishna theology, Krishna chooses to live in a neighborhood in the spiritual world where no one there thinks that he's God. Everyone who's there loves him, not because he's God, but because he's Krishna. They actually love him for himself. And so there's these different relationships, and it's in that spirit that some souls choose to love God as a parent of God. And you have this in, they say in Italy, they have this in Catholicism, by the way, it was married, like in Italy, people get real excited, and they say something like, Santa Maria, Madre di Dio, which means like, Holy Mary, Mother of God, which is better than some things we say when we get excited, beginning with the word mother. So, anyway, in Catholicism also, they had this idea, Mary's the mother of God, so that you can actually love God, or you can love the person that's fully man, fully God, anyway, that you can be the mother of God. And so you find these other traditions as well, because it's such a powerful love, it's such a powerful emotion, which you can direct toward God, not as God, but simply as the person that God is. And then ultimately, the gold medal goes to Madhuri Rasa, which is conjugal love for God, that one can actually become a pure lover of God. Not in the sense of just shacking up in cheap motels, but in the sense of a pure romantic love. And you find this also in Christianity, by the way. And for example, St. John of the Cross, it's called in Christian theology bridal mysticism, where one becomes the bride of God. And the idea being that the soul, a soul who is inclined to be a feminine soul. I mean, the gender of our bodies is not really relevant here. It's not that if you have a female material body, it means that your soul is inclined to love God as a female or male. It's just, but the idea being that souls, when people take their spiritual bodies, they may be male or female. And so some souls actually are attracted to a conjugal relationship with God. God, not as this, I mean, you really couldn't fall in love with some big, glowing, old deity. Probably. I mean, probably wouldn't get a crush on someone like that. But if you consider that God, or from this point of view, from the Vaishnava point of view, God is young, he's actually a teenager, and infinitely beautiful, infinitely good-looking, like the supreme, eternal rock star, then some people actually can fall in love with Krishna in that way. And you find the same idea in other traditions, in mystic. I mean, I'm sure in Sufism you'll find some strain like this, in the mystic aspects of other religions. And the gopis, of course, the cowherd girls of Vrindavan, are the most famous. Also Krishna, when he went to Dwarka, he had queens there. And so that's one way to love God, according to this tradition and according to other traditions. So anything about that so far? Yes?
I'm wondering, why isn't one of the relationships to have Krishna be your parent?
Oh, that is there. That would be this one.
So it's Krishna, you're Krishna's parent, and Krishna is your parent?
Well, it depends on which one attracts you more.
Okay, so there is a
reason. Yeah, you have to sort of really try hard and think your way back to a very, very ancient time when children actually would obey their parents. And so it was kind of like that. There was a time, you look at culture, back in Scandinavia, read the Song of the Volsungs, In other cultures, well, parents have the power of life and death over their children. I mean, if parents could actually, a parent, the mother or father, could just choose to kill a teenage child. This was the kind of thing like, I wouldn't do it personally, but it shouldn't be illegal. Anyway, so Vatsalya Rasa includes that. And so the idea is that every one of us, this is the idea which you find in Ramanuja, you find in other literatures, and certainly in Rupa, is that every one of us already has an eternal relationship with God that we've forgotten. All of us have an eternal identity that we simply don't remember. And that as one engages in spiritual practices, that you begin to wake up and your eternal identity becomes obvious to you, and you realize who you really are eternally. And then you sort of, you know, again, accept the spiritual body and you have your eternal life with God. So that's the idea. Any questions on that topic? If not, we're going to go on to the spring blockbuster, which is something very different, the arrival of the Europeans in India. Even with, well, not car chase scenes, but there are boat chase scenes. By the way, in addition to these five primary rasas, there, I'll just mention it so I can go on record as having told you this, there are also seven secondary rasas, which are, and of course, this was a system that was used by many other thinkers in many other traditions, Abhinavagupta and Kashmir and so on. There are the ecstasy of laughing, of astonishment, chivalry, compassion, anger, dread, ghastliness, which sort of come in and out of the different relationships. Like if you love God in a certain way, in this sense, and then at different times you may be astonished, you may be laughing, you may be chivalrous. So those are the... Anyway, you can read about it. Google rasa. Now, going back to the other topic, something very important happened in 1453. Well, in 1453, believe it or not, the Roman Empire finally ended. It actually, because, you know, the Roman Empire divided into East and West, and actually the more sophisticated part of the empire was in the East, with its capital in Constantinople, named after the Emperor Constantine. And so even though Rome fell 1,000 years before this, for another 1,000 years, the empire actually went on in the East. Finally, the Muslims, they finally, it was, of course, a very tough city. It's now Istanbul. It's a very tough city to defeat because they had these incredible fortifications because of the geographic situation. But finally, in 1453, the Turks, the Muslim Turks, took over Constantinople. Now, so what? Well, here's the so what. At that time, the two major areas of human population on Earth, in terms of lots of people, everyone just freeze. Okay, they won't detect us. So, one area, of course, was Europe. One area was Europe, all of Europe. The other area was Asia. Asia. And because of the desert conditions in a lot of the Middle East, there just weren't as many people there. In the Middle East and even North Africa, it's quite dry. So the world trade, to a great extent, world trade meant trade between Asia, South and East Asia, and Europe. And a key city was Constantinople. That was a key trading place because the Silk Routes from China, the whole India, I mean, things were going to Constantinople. So when that fell, all these ancient trade relationships were disrupted in 1453. And the Muslims that took over Constantinople began charging exorbitant tariffs, like taxes, to get the merchandise through to Europe. And all kinds of good things, like sugar and spices. We always hear about the spice trade and other luxury items. And so this was a major problem. This was a major problem. And that's why, after the fall of Constantinople, there was this really strong desire to find another way to get to India and the East, because it totally disrupted world trade. As you know, there's nothing more important or sacred on this planet than world trade. And so Anyway, Spain, as they freed themselves from the Moors and freed themselves from all kinds of oppressions like religious freedom and so on, with La Reconquista, you had this wave of sort of like violent religious enthusiasm in Spain, and they also wanted to defeat the Muslims, and they wanted to do business, and so they decided, we've got to go to India. And that's why, of course, they financed Columbus. Colón is Italian. So that's why they financed them. They had two objectives in trying to get to India. And ultimately, not only the Spanish, but then the Portuguese, for the same reasons. So the Portuguese got there first. Spain was kind of tied up in the New World, providing all kinds of educational and cultural facilities for indigenous peoples. So while the Spanish were doing that, the Portuguese, thought, we got to get to India. They have, two purposes, economic for world trade, and secondly, the world was just coming out of the Dark Ages, and people in Europe believed that India was a Christian country. And because St. Thomas had gone there, they figured, well, if St. Thomas went there, he was such a great sage, saint, he must have just converted everybody. So they actually thought that India was Christian. They thought, if we can get to India and team up with our Christian brothers in India, we can have a type of pincer movement. In other words, we can squash the Muslims between India and Europe. Now, there's a problem with the Portuguese, and that is the Renaissance. The Renaissance had really not gotten that far. Portugal at that time, even though it's, let's say, late 1400s, even up to the end of the 15th century, into the 1500s, even though the Renaissance has been going on for a few hundred years, well, maybe 150 years, in other parts of Europe, it just hasn't gotten to Portugal yet. They are squarely, solidly in the Middle Ages, as in Dark Ages. And such things, well, let me tell you what they did when they got to Portugal. First of all, to India. They arrived in India, and I don't know if I can do a map view real quick, but anyway, here's Europe up here, and they kind of sailed around Africa, and they came up to, this is India, just, the first part of India they came to was just southwest India. And these were Portuguese sailors who would take bath at least once or twice a year. In other words, they would go months and months without bathing, so they reeked. These people reeked. And when they arrived on these, now, as far as Indian culture is concerned, the coast was not really the big thing. It was not like the New World, where the big cities are Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, L.A., San Francisco. Everything's on the coast because of world trade. That's why the original big cities in America are on the coast, because of world trade. That's why London was so prominent. If you look at Western Europe, because they have a very easy outlet to the rest of the world. England, France, Spain, there's a reason why, for example, Poland didn't have a lot of colonies, or even Germany. So at a certain point, it was the countries that had access to the ocean that got into world trade. But back in India, it wasn't like that. India was such a rich country, world trade, typically, even with the Roman Empire, they had a tremendous problem in world trade with India, because India had lots of things the Romans wanted, and the Romans had almost nothing India wanted. So they had to pay with gold. So it was a major gold drain. It was a major trade deficit. Something America would never become involved in. So anyway, there was a trade deficit in even Europe. So even going into now, let's say the 1400s, 1500s, there's a problem because India had so many things. So for India, almost everything important that went on in India went on in the heartland. And on the coast, there were little kingdoms and trading centers. They would trade with Arabs, they would trade with people from Japan, from China. So there was world trade going on along the east and west coast of India, but there were no important cities on the coast. All the important Indian cities today on the coast, like Bombay, the financial center, and Mumbai, and Chennai, the former Madras, and Calcutta, which you can get to by going up the Bay of Bengal. Those were all European trade centers. So when the Europeans first came to the coast, In India, no one took it that seriously. It's like, okay, they're trading on the coast. It's just something out there on the coast. And in southwest India, there were world trade centers. People were coming from all around the world to trade. When the Portuguese came, they told the local ruler that you cannot trade anymore with the Muslims. It's like, what? This was an open society, free world trade, and the Portuguese come in, reeking, and just announce that you're not allowed to trade with Muslims, with Arabs anymore, or Muslims, even though you've been trading with these people, for thousands of years. You can't trade with them anymore. Now, at that point, Europe didn't really have any technological superiority, except that they had very fast ships, and they had really far-out cannons. So in terms of cannon and fast ships, they were a little bit ahead. Otherwise, they had no technological advantage. It wasn't like after the Industrial Revolution. And so people thought, these people are crazy and they smell bad. However, the Portuguese, being deeply medieval, they began just to do things, like really cute little things like bombarding towns on the coast. And you're like, what are you doing? Like, no one did things like this. And they would capture Muslim ships and basically sometimes burn everyone alive, including ships going on pilgrimage, with men, women, and children. They would just sometimes let the people get off the ship before they burned it, sometimes steal the ship, sometimes just burn everybody on the ship. They would capture fishermen who somehow or other displeased them and cut off their noses and ears. Anyway, they were the Portuguese. Not that all Portuguese at all times have been like that, but these people were a little out of control. Now, they arrived in 1498. The first 2 years the Portuguese were in India or in contact with India, they still thought India was a Christian country. So they went to a local Hindu temple in southwest India, which might have been a temple to Shakti, the goddess, whatever, and they thought, oh my God, the Virgin Mary. And so, all these Portuguese sailors would go in and kneel and bow, and for 2 years, they were worshiping Mary at a Hindu temple. Finally, they found out these are not Christians, and they took. They, as if the Hindus had tried to convince them they were Christians. So they got really unhappy about it, and basically declared war on Hinduism. And of course, they'd been at war with Muslims for forever. But now Hindus also, and so. The Portuguese policy, basically, at a certain point, as they established colonies, because they eventually won sea battles. They were good sailors, and they began to win sea battles. They began to control the coast, develop what is called a thessalocracy, which, as you all know, means a sort of the ruling the sea. And now, in 1536, in Europe, something very inspiring began, and that was the Inquisition. And it began in 1536, and actually in Portugal, the Inquisitions. Now, the reason they had the Inquisitions, among other reasons, main reason probably just to steal the property of non-Christians, but the ostensible reason was that after La Reconquista, after Spain and Portugal drove out the Muslims, the Moors, they got very, very heavy. Everyone had to be a Catholic. Everyone had to be a Catholic. If you didn't want to be a Catholic, then you could literally go to hell by being killed. And so many people converted because, okay, tortured and killed, become a Catholic. Okay, I'll become a Catholic. Now, many of these people, Jews and Muslims, they officially converted, but secretly they were still Jews and Muslims. And so they just continued to practice their own religions. And the Spanish and Portuguese thought that that's not fair because you said you were converting. So in the spirit of justice, they thought we need to really inquire into this, as in, to be inquisitive, as in Inquisition. And so they began to inquire, like, are you really a Catholic? Or are you faking it? Like, what do you do at home when all the lights are out and so on? And so that was the Inquisition. And, of course, if they thought that something was wrong with you, they would torture you in some of the most ingenious ways ever invented by sick minds and kill people. And so By 1560, the Inquisition came to India, Goa. Goa became, the Portuguese invested in Goa, it's in southwest India. Still, it's a big, if you sometimes see Bollywood films, anyway, people rock out there. It's a very popular tourist destination for Europeans and Americans because they have beautiful beaches and, you know, you're far from home and can do crazy things. Like they say, you know, whatever happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. So, the Portuguese built up Goa, and they have this expression in Portuguese, if anyone knows Portuguese, King Vio Goa, Excusa de Ver Lisboa, which means whoever has seen Goa is excused from seeing Lisboa, Lisbon, because it was like a rival of Lisbon. People used to have sayings like that in other cities. Like in Italy, they used to say, Vedi Napoli, poi muori, that see Naples, and then you can die. Like, don't die until you've seen Naples. Of course, you literally can't see it now because it's covered most of the year with a thick shroud of smog. But in the old days when you could actually see it, it was very beautiful. So, anyway, all this stuff is going on. Any questions about this so far? So the Portuguese, not only would they not bathe, they also tended to be alcoholics. Because when you have a long time at sea and there are no lady friends around, and nothing to do, and so they drank. And they would drink night and day, and they would get, if they were wild sober, they were even wilder drunk. Anyway, all this stuff is going on, the Portuguese ruled, then something happened. Just very quickly, so you just go over the history. What happened is that Spain conquered Portugal and kind of assimilated Portugal. That was in late 1500s. And then something even worse happened. So that kind of put a crimp in the Portuguese style. Spain, of course, kept these colonies going. But then what happened in 1588, as you know, the Spanish Armada was defeated. The Spanish Armada was defeated, or not defeated, they were foiled, you could say, in their attempt to invade England. And that changed world history. I mean, one of the reasons we don't speak Spanish right now, well, we do speak Spanish in America, but one of the reasons we don't have Spanish as our primary language yet is that because of the way the wind was blowing in 1588. Anyway, if there's a scientific study of why the Spanish Armada failed, the largest naval attack in history. And if you study the coast, as the Royal Naval Academy has done in England, if you study the coast of England and you sort of by computer analysis try to figure out like what were the sea conditions, the meteorology back then, it turns out that as they came up from Spain, as they came up to the southern coast of England, they just hit the wrong kind of weather. The sea currents were going the wrong way. They didn't have these huge, you know, mechanized, motorized ships we have nowadays. And they simply couldn't find, and they tried to land in the port. It was a little difficult, it was tricky, and then, meanwhile, England, just if you want to know what happened, England just like threw everything they had that would float, including probably like little toy ships and everything, everything, all the pirates, all the navy, anything that would float, they threw into it. And they came around behind the Spanish Armada, just kind of harassed them, made it more difficult to land. The Spanish Armada sort of went farther east, trying to find a port. At a certain point, you get the Cliffs of Dover. No, that's not the Cliffs of Dover. That's somewhere else. The Cliffs of Dover. At a certain point, the English coast gets very steep. You can't land. So the Spanish Armada had to sort of make a left turn, go up the eastern coast of England, being harassed all the way. By the time they came around the other side, they went back to Spain. So, anyway, with the defeat of the Spanish Armada, England and also Holland, that was fighting wars with Spain over Spain's attempt to re-Catholicize the lowlands. England and Holland jumped into Asia like, woohoo, you know, we just defeated the Spanish Armada, now we can go get some stuff too. Now, what's interesting is the Catholics, the French and the Spanish, and the Portuguese were fanatical about religious conversion, and that messed up the business. Like, you open a store somewhere and have people preaching at the door, it's not good business. So the Spanish and the French, because they were so fanatically trying to convert the local people, ultimately failed. The English and the Dutch went there absolutely opposed any type of religious proselytizing. Like, we don't want, they didn't want land, they didn't want territory, they didn't want to govern anything, they wanted to do business. It was the East India Trading Company, the VOC, United Asian Company in Holland, and we're out of time, but we'll talk more. But anyway, so you have this new wave of colonization, but things will change in Europe, and eventually England will take over India. So, have a good weekend. See you on Monday.